This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 292 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. How are we? And greetings to all of our listeners this week.
Yeah, I'm doing well, David. It's nice to talk with you again. This is going to be a little bit of a different show this episode. Most of the time, I think this little podcast runs like a well-oiled machine. But
here comes the but, folks. This is not going to be one of those episodes. Well, it'll run like a well-oiled machine, like if Max and I were recording on Thursdays. But that's a whole different podcast.
That's right. Well, this time, Rob Mark is off. He's on a special assignment providing aviation news analysis to Fox News in New York. And we're hoping that we'll see him again next week. But he's off. And I'm on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay, where the internet gets here by a long, long, thin wire. Yeah, that's when it's up. So hopefully things will work well enough for David and I to get through this episode.
And me, I'm sitting where I normally sit at this time on Monday nights. I'm in my office, so I'm the only normality as far as this show is concerned.
All right. Well, let's see how we do, David. Here's what we're going to do. David and I are going to talk about a couple of aviation news stories from the past week. And then we have kind of a special airplane of the week, don't we, David?
We do. And I'm going to leave it as a surprise. And I think everyone will be really, really shocked when we get to it.
Yes, this is going to be different. And I think very good. I'm pretty excited about this.
And I am too. And it might be a reoccurring feature.
All right. So we'll leave it at that for now. And then in this week's Australia Desk report, Grant is away also. So Steve is joined by Ben Jones, Ben from Perth, Western Australia. And they're going to talk about the recent increase in air traffic as aircraft from a number of nations stage up from our AAF base Pierce in the search for flight MH370. And they're also going to talk about the CASA airworthiness directive for the vintage Tiger Moth. And then in his Across the Pond segment, Peter introduces a new guest contributor, Marissa Garcia from Denmark, and they're going to talk about aviation in Scandinavia. They also discuss Marissa's background in aircraft interior design and her website, Flight Chic. And they're going to talk about some of the major Danish airlines, airports, and some other items along those lines. So we look forward to that. And then Dave and I are going to talk about some of the listener mail that we received recently. And we've got some exciting stuff from all of you. So we'll look forward to that. All right. So let's get started right away with some of the news stories. David, you ready?
I am. Let's go.
All right. We see from WBAY. EAA and FAA reach agreement for AirVenture. Now, as you'll recall, there was a little bit of an issue last year at AirVenture at Oshkosh where the FAA, because of sequestration, said that they would not be providing air traffic control services for free. Of course, that airport, Dave, I think that becomes the largest or the busiest airport in the world, or at least in the U.S. for that that week of AirVenture.
Well, actually, the world is the right thing. Our beloved Whitman Airport gets to be the busiest airport in the world for 1 week. And the air traffic controllers are usually volunteers, and they volunteer their time to wear their pink shirts. And last year it cost them EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association, $447,000 for the week to keep the airport open and to keep the tower open. So this year they've come to an agreement. The agreement will last until 2022. And hopefully we'll get Rob back so he can be more specific. But according to Dick Kapinski, we had to send him a check last year, so we paid them the $447,000. But this year, for instance, let's say the cost would be the same, it would be another $447,000, and they'll take half of that and apply it as a credit. Now, there was a lawsuit to get that money back, and the agreement seems to be that they're going to pay them going forward, but they're going to negotiate the payment each year. That was my interpretation. The article wasn't very clear on how the settlement was going to work, huh, Max?
Yeah, there's a lot of information in that article. And like you say, David, it's kind of hard to parse out exactly what it means. It does note that the FAA, it says, will provide air traffic control and other services. However, the EAA covers the cost of travel, accommodation, and overtime for the controllers. That sounds kind of reasonable. But I guess the big thing is that there seems to be an agreement that all parties can live with. Certainly the situation from last year isn't really sustainable. I mean, for the EAA to come up with $500,000 each year for obviously really valuable services and important and critical services. You can't run a show like that without having this kind of air traffic control. But at that expense, at that cost, that's pretty tough. I mean, the only way to sort of handle that, I think, is to pass that on to the participants at the show, the visitors and so forth. And that's, you know, that's kind of tough.
And it does clear the air, so we're not worried about. They did talk in the article that one of the options was not have AirVenture, which for all of us AV geeks would be that would be a nightmare.
Yeah, you can't do that. We can't do that.
we can't have that. I mean, it's bad enough that some of us had to suffer without the Blues and the Birds last year, but no AirVenture at all. That's kind of a frightening prospect. So it sounds like everybody is sort of not necessarily happy, but not necessarily unhappy either. So I think it's a good step in the right direction. And are you still following up on your plans? Are you going to be there for 2014?
I'm planning on it. And you are as well, I assume.
We'll see.
Okay.
At least two of the three of us will be there.
All right. Well, our next item, this was in Policy Mike, and the headline just kind of grabs your attention, which is, you won't find Delta's latest perk on any other airline. Okay, what's that? Well, Delta apparently is partnering with LinkedIn to host some flights called Innovation Class, where if you're lucky enough to win this, you can fly alongside certain industry thought leaders, and they can sort of act as mentors, I guess, and this is your opportunity to sit next to someone kind of special on a flight and, I guess, bend their ear or benefit from their wisdom or carry on, well, I guess, whatever kind of a conversation you want to. It's kind of an interesting idea.
And it's cross-country long flights, so basically you get your elevator speech prepared for about 3 hours. It's interesting. I don't know that I would feel comfortable talking to a mentor for 3 hours on a flight, you know, because I'll be looking out the window, not really paying attention to the guy sitting
right
next to me.
Oh, come on, David. If you could sit, let me ask you this. If you could sit next to anybody living, let's say, and would have an opportunity to sit next to them for a cross-country flight, for a three-hour flight, anybody pop into your head? Anybody you'd just love to spend the time chatting with?
Oh, I don't know. Someone who's got good stories. That's always gets me. I mean, I got to spend time with John Glenn, so that takes that one out.
That's pretty special.
Bob Hoover would come to mind. Someone who would tell me great stories, and it could, I don't know. That's a tough question. How about you? Do you have anybody that, oh, I know one, a friend of the show. I think I could spend 3 hours listening to Igor talk.
Yes.
Igor Sikorsky.
Yes, the third. Yes, Igor Sikorsky, the third. Yes, that would be, that's a great example. You know, maybe we should ask our listeners, David, if you had the opportunity, you know, as part of this Delta thing, sure, but just in general, if you had the opportunity to sit next to someone for a 3 hour flight, who would you pick? And it has to be someone living. I can think of lots of people who are not living that I would love to chat with.
That's the old go back in time. Who would you, yeah? It just I'd like, and for granted, I'd like to go back to see Richard Pearson and watch him not fly his airplane, or go to Connecticut and watch Gustav. No, who was
Gustav Whitehead?
Gustav Whitehead.
Yeah,
and what? And bring back a flashlight so I can not watch him fly across at night. But yeah, this is definitely a question for our listeners.
Yeah, we might get some interesting responses. So yeah, send those in to us.
But you didn't answer. Who did you want to sit with?
I'm not sure. It would probably be some kind of a politician who I could ask, what the hell are you guys thinking, or something like that, you know?
Yeah, that would be a very short conversation.
Yeah, that's true. That'd be a poor use of my 3 hours.
I like that, though. You know, you ask a stupid question, they give you a stupid answer, and then you can go out and stare at the window and not feel bad about
that's right.
It. Oh, but dear. Talking about expertise, the next article is right up your alley, huh?
Oh, this is from Gizmag. Nanoparticle coating could let aircraft engines last three times longer. That's the title. So this is kind of interesting, at least to some people, which is that some scientists at Sweden's University West, they have been developing a new coating, which they say this is like an airfoil coating, like a turbine blade coating. They said they could extend service life of an engine by 300%. So, and I think we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but obviously the inside of a jet engine is really hot, really hot. Especially in the turbine stages, just directly behind the combustion chamber. And so a number of techniques are used in order to keep the turbine blades and the stators from melting, from overheating, from distorting and changing shape, and that sort of thing. And typically that's done with cooling air that is kind of pumped through the blades and then out through tiny holes, usually laser drilled holes in the blades. They create a boundary layer, but also through coatings, typically ceramic coatings or other exotic coatings. And the engine manufacturers tend to be fairly secretive as to the chemistry, the secret sauce that makes up their coatings. So these guys in Sweden have come up with something that's based on some nanoparticles. Do you know what nanoparticles are, David?
Go off of my Latin, I would say nano being small and particle being a particle of something.
Yeah, really, really small. Really, really, really small. Something that's measured in microns. So without going into it too deep, it's kind of interesting. If you have a material, you know, a block of material, it's got some properties. I don't know what kind of properties, melting points, just a whole variety of different properties. And if you cut that material in half and you have two halves, they pretty much have the same properties. And you cut that in half, you have smaller pieces, and they have the same properties. But it turns out that once you get to like really, really small particles of that material, the properties can change and they can exhibit different properties. It's sort of as you get down to almost the molecular level, the properties change. And so you can take materials that behave, you know, one way normally, and if you make them small enough, they can do interesting things. So what these researchers have done is come up with some particles that have some properties that are desirable in terms of protecting the turbine blades and vanes in a jet engine.
So these particles are made out of, it's a mixture of ceramic and plastic. And the ceramic particles provide insulation. But the plastic ones give some, they have some elasticity. They can expand and contract. So as the metal changes shape slightly, this new kind of coating can actually expand and contract slightly with it, which prevents cracking and things like that. So it's interesting. It's another example of how the technology keeps advancing. Once you have these nanoparticles, they're applied through a plasma spray. And basically you heat this stuff up to somewhere between 12,000 and 14,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty hot. And you basically, that causes the ceramic will actually melt at that temperature. Normally ceramic doesn't melt, but at that temperature it does. And then you sort of blast it onto the airfoils, onto the engine parts. And so you have this different kind of material that provides this insulating capability that's above and beyond, these guys say, what's available now. So interesting. We talk, David, sometimes about how, you know, increasing costs of, you know, the next airplane or the next jet engine. And we kind of marvel at, you know, why do these things cost so much? Why do these things take so long to develop?
Besides
R&D. And, you know, this is kind of another example. I mean, obviously, well, I say obviously, presumably it's taken years to develop this to the point that it's been developed. And it's going to take years to, you know, to prove that it, well, first of all, does what it's supposed to do. But also that it's, you know, it's got the durability, it's got the maintainability and all the other and the manufacturability that's necessary to bring this stuff to, you know, to the market. So, it, you know, again, it's another example of why these things seem to cost so much and take so long these days.
And why it's suddenly the next big thing is slower and slower to come.
Right, exactly.
Whereas we deal in a universe with computers and stuff where there's an acceleration of technology, a lot of these kind of technologies, these mechanical technologies, and it's slowing down because the next step is it's more incremental. It's not quantum leaps. And so it's definitely interesting that, you know, you're talking about this stuff, but this is like maybe 15 years, 20 years down the road for it to be a practical application. And you're getting 300% shelf life. But, you know, think about the difference between turboprops and turbojets and piston engines and that whole thing where things change so rapidly. And now we're sort of slowly pacing along with just gradual improvements.
All right. That's kind of our technology item for this episode.
This has been Engines with Max Flight.
Another one. All right. Well, listen, let's give the mic now to Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association, and he's going to tell us what to expect in this week's NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, guys. This week on NBAA's Flight Plan, have you ever wanted to go to Asia? Vicariously, anyway, here's your chance as we talk about ABAES, the Asian Business Aviation Conference and Exhibition. It takes place in Shanghai next month. Yeah, that's how you pronounce it, Shanghai. For one major business aviation organization, ABAES is a launch pad for expanding its efforts throughout Asia. You'll find us at the National Business Aviation Association website. That's nbaa.org.
David, I like the Flight Plan podcast. It's probably the shortest podcast I know about. It's typically like 5 minutes. So, you know, we think the UAV Digest is concise at 30 minutes. This really boils it down to the essence, and it's a great listen, and check it out.
Definitely give them a shout.
All right, and now it's time for the Aircraft of the Week.
This is Jamie Dodson with the Airplane Geeks Plane of the Week, the PZL-104 Wilga. The Wilga was manufactured by the Polish PZL Corporation. It was designed and built as a short takeoff and landing civilian aviation utility aircraft. The Wilga has evolved through many ever-improving versions during its continuous production run from 1962 to 2006. with an all-aluminum construction, the Vilga, or Golden Oriole, is a high-wing cantilever monoplane with a conventional layout. The main cabin is constructed of riveted and corrugated duraluminum to increase the strength and durability of the low-mass semi-monocoque fuselage. The rectangular single-spar wing is fitted with slotted flaps and anti-stall slats. The four-seat cabin is equipped with two large side doors that open upwards. This facilitates large loads and rapid entry and exit. The main wheels are attached to an articulated conventional fixed pneumatic shock landing gear with heavy-duty sprung tail wheel and a glider tow hook. The early models featured a two-bladed composite wooden propeller matched to a Russian-designed end-chain engine that rotated in the opposite direction from the North American standard. The newest models of the Vilgas use a full metal propeller and the North American Continental O 470 engine with standard rotation. Two 52 U.S. gallon fuel tanks are located in the wings. The Vilga II airframe had provided a successful design, but the WN6RB engine was not fully developed and so did not enter serial production. As a result, PLZ decided to use an in-production radial engine, the 260 horsepower Ichenkov AL114R. This led to the PZL-104 Vilga Mark III variant, which first flew in December of 1965. The new engine was more powerful, but it spoilt the previously clean and aerodynamic fuselage lines designed for a flat engine. The new Mark III variant was successful. The combination of powerful engine and stall airframe capability provided an extraordinarily high rate of climb, about 2,165 feet per minute under a minimum load. One of the few remaining flaws was the relatively uneconomical engine. The Vilga 3-2 was an improved small series export variant with a Continental flat engine produced also in Indonesia as the Galik. After producing 13 Vilga 3-S's, PLZ made some additional improvements. Most notably, a landing gear base increased from 7 to 9.3 feet, which improved stability. An improved model, designated the PZL-104 Vilga 3-5, first flew in June of 1967, subsequently entering mass production. The most numerous variant of the Vilga 3-5 was the utility plane, the Vilga 3-5 Alpha. Others were built in small numbers and remain prototypes. In 1979, the Vilga 80 went into production, an improved model certified for the U.S. market. In the late 1990s, the PZL-104MA Vilga 2000 family was developed with Lycoming flat engines and improved aerodynamics. Over 1,000 Vilgas of all types have been built, including 935 of the Vilga 3-5 and 80, making the PZL-104 Vilga the highest volume production run of any Polish airplane. A Canadian aircraft supplier even considered building the Vilga aircraft for the Air Cadet League due to its complete compliance with glider training requirements and the need for more aircraft. However, they were unable to get full support of IADS to further produce the plane in Canada. Vilgas are used in civil aviation for touring, observation, glider towing, parachute training, and bush flying. In Poland, they form the backbone contingent of the Polish Aero Club, where they are the basic aircraft used in flight training. Polish pilots flying Vilgas have won numerous prizes for the FAI World Rally Flying and Precision Flying Championships from 1978 to 2006. In military service, they are used as liaisons, recovery, and light observation platforms. This is Jamie Dodson for the Airplane Geeks, reporting from Rocket City, Alabama.
Well, folks, as you can tell, that wasn't me. Thanks, Jamie. That was a great article on the Vilga. And Jamie has decided to fall on his sword and volunteer to occasionally bail me out on Airplanes of the Week or history segments. So I'm looking forward to us collaborating together and coming up with some more great stories. And I can take a breather from writing 1 week, or if I take a week off, JB, who is a wonderful writer, and that was a great first attempt, Jamie. So I really appreciate you taking the time. It got me off the hook. I could focus a little bit more being a co-host this week. And we'll look forward to more from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you'd like to hear more from Jamie or read some of my favorite books, and you like flying boats, go to nickgrantadventures.com for all things Jamie.
Great.
And Jamie Dodson and Nick Grant. So thank you very much, Jamie, and I look forward to more coming from you.
All right, now it's time for, well, Steve and sometimes Grant in this week's Australia Desk Report.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 23rd of March, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 292. And yes, of course, that's not Grant McHaren here. He's off sick this week, so we've dragged back in at very short notice our Western Australian correspondent, Ben Jones. How are you, Jonesy?
I'm very good, Steve. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, of course, you're over there in Perth on the other side of the country from me, and it is, at the moment, the centre of the Australian universe when it comes to aviation. There seems to be all sorts of interesting movements going on there because that's basically where all the aircraft are staging from in the never-ending search, it seems, for missing Malaysia Airlines flight 370.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be the centre of the media world.
Yes, I tell you what now, how come we're not getting good media rides? I've seen, of course, the Air Force, our Air Force and the Kiwi Air Force are operating a bunch of P3 Orions out to the search area, and it seems like all the lesser traditional media are getting on those aircraft and we're not.
Yeah, it's unfortunate about that, but good luck to them, because sitting in looking at the window for 10 to 12 hours on an Orion is not very fun. I've done it once before, and it's not as cracked up to be.
Yeah, of course. Now, mate, they're staging there out of RAF Base Pierce, which is just north of the city of Perth, if memory serves. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It's about 45 kilometres from the Central Business District, or the actual city of Perth itself.
And, you know, they see these aircraft coming in there. Of course, we're operating Orions, but what do they normally use that base for?
Predominantly, the base is a training base, so we have our PC-9s. We have the lead-in Hawk jet trainers, and also the Singaporean Air Force are using, I believe, their PC-21s now to do their ab initio training also.
So we've got, according to the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, who's coordinating the search out way out to the southwest of Perth, and we're talking about 2,500 kilometres, we believe three P-3 Orions from the Royal Australian Air Force and a P-3K-2 Orion from the Royal New Zealand Air Force. There's also a P-8 Poseidon from the US Navy that's operating. I don't think that's operating out of Pierce, though. I'm not sure where that's staging out of. And I know the Indians are operating a P-8, but I think that's coming out of Malaysia as well. They've also got some civil aircraft coming out of there, a Global Express, a Gulfstream 5, and an Airbus 319. And, you know, Jonesy, if that's the 319 I'm thinking of, it's probably the one that normally goes down to the South Pole. So I'd say that's got quite a lot of endurance on that one.
Yeah, that aircraft certainly has a lot of fuel reserves for that kind of flying in case of weather.
If you get out there to RAF Base Pierce, just from an airplane geek's point of view, is there you know, many vantage points for plane spotting? I imagine with all this activity there, in fact, I believe even the Chinese have been taking some aircraft out there, you know, that would make some great plane spotting opportunities, I'm sure.
There probably is a couple of vantage points around the base to see the movements, but I guarantee you people are hurried along very quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting, talking about the Chinese aircraft that was coming in this week, a link that you sent me, actually, an interesting story that's not exactly confirmed. On first read, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, it appears as though this Chinese IL-76 aircraft was inbound for RAF Base Pierce and ended up landing at Perth International Airport. Now, the inference of that article would have you believe, I guess, that it landed there by mistake. I find that a little hard to believe, but I think we probably come up with a more plausible explanation for why that might have happened.
Yes, I've only ever seen that news report from the one source, and it hasn't been confirmed, but most likely it had to drop into Perth Airport so the crew could clear customs before hopping back in the aircraft and doing a 8-minute hop up to Pierce and starting their duties from there.
Yeah, well, there you go. Now, talking about plane spotting, I know that Perth International Airport, they've actually got a very good area there for watching planes, so that would have been quite a sight for those that were out there with their cameras at the ready.
Yes, they about a year and a half ago, they finished the construction of an observatory platform on the western side of the airport, just beside the highway, and the facilities there are really, really nice, and you get up on an elevated area and look out over the apron. It's really nice to go and have a look at.
If we sent you you out to the airport observation area there on an assignment, how many hours or days would I need to leave you there for to get a proper report?
To be very thorough in the report, I think I'd be out there for a couple of days straight, Steve.
Oh, no worries. I can send you out with a cut lunch and two bottles of water. How's that sound?
That sounds great to me.
Now, you're also into the home building and all that sort of stuff, so you're all up with things like airworthiness directives or ADs, dreaded things, I guess, all around the world when it comes to civil aviation, but they're always with a reason. And the Civil Aviation Authority has recently issued some ADs relating to vintage Tiger Moth aircraft. A lot of that fleet's been grounded recently over safety concerns.
Yeah, Steve, we had a Tiger Moth, unfortunately, crash late last year, and the ensuing investigation has realised that there could be some faults with fuselage tie rods in the Tiger Moth fleet. So this airworthiness directive basically grounded all Tiger Moths instantly on the spot from doing aerobatics, and they had up to 10 hours to do these mandatory checks of these fuselage tie rods. Now, the fuselage tie rods in the Tiger Moth pretty much tie the two wings to the center section and carry any load forces through from one wing through the fuselage to the other wing. So it's a fairly major structural part of the aircraft. They are periodically replaced every 2,000 hours in the aircraft. So a lot of the fittings that have failed are not, 80 years old, but still, an old aircraft doing aerobatics, you need to maintain and check a couple of things, routinely. So that's why they have these checks every 2,000 hours on the tie rods.
And it's interesting here, reading a bit further down this article, that they actually found some evidence linking these tie rods and making them, go down this path of investigation by evidence collected from a video camera that was on board the aircraft that unfortunately crashed. The plane's left wing had failed 1 minute into a manoeuvre. At the end of this article, it mentions that the lateral tie rods that failed in the accident aircraft were fitted as newly manufactured items in 2006 and had about 1,300 hours of service life on them at the time of the crash. It's funny, I look at those aircraft, and as much as I love flying them, I've never been up in a Tiger Moth. I don't know whether you have or anything of that vintage, but I don't know, it just doesn't do it for me, unfortunately.
Yes, I'm actually endorsed on the Tiger Moth to fly it as pilot in command, and I'm against doing aerobatic flights in old vintage aircraft. The aircraft are old, they're well maintained, so there's no issues, but why push the limits when you don't have to?
Yes, well, I don't know. My local airfield, about 20 minutes from me, has a Tiger Moth down there periodically doing joy flights, and maybe I should get them to take me up for an experience one day. Maybe I'll be brave enough, but then again, I might even be able to be brave enough to take a ride in one of Grant's balloons one of these days.
I'd go the Tiger Moth first.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, mate, well, I think that's everything we've got this week. Now, of course, Grant did compile a heap of notes here, and of course, as usual, the top of the list is full of Qantas stuff, but we always talk about that, so let's just give Qantas a rest this week. I don't think there's any Qantas news you wanted to talk about, was there?
Not particularly, not this week.
Okay, fantastic. Well, that's Grant's pet subject, so we'll hope that he's back off his sick bed next week. So until then, I'm Steve Vischer. Ben Jones, thanks very much for joining us again, mate.
No worries, Steve.
Cheers, mate.
All right, guys, thanks. It's always nice to hear from Ben. I mean, too bad that Grant's away, but Ben is always an interesting guy to listen to, and I guess they kind of consider Ben to be their Western Australia correspondent.
Yeah, if you're good. And it's convenient because, with all of those missions flying out of Perth, it's very convenient to have Ben, and we really appreciate him being part of the PCDU West team and the Airplane Geek South team, so... But yeah, and folks, next week I will start, since we've been talking a lot about P3s, I'll start off with a 3-week run. We're going to do 3 weeks of the Lockheed Electra and P3 Orion. So look forward to that. And it's pretty cool, though, that Tiger Moths are still flying, considering they were built in like the 20s.
I know.
The airworthiness directive to keep them flying is a really cool thing. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time, and a very interesting aspect of warbirds and having to do directives about aircraft that so they can keep them flying and not just ground them and put them in museums. Oh, and one last thing. You can find Ben on Twitter at CJ1 Corby Starlet, CORBYSTARLET.
And where does that come from?
Ben, you need to let us know where that comes from.
Yeah, I can't figure that one out. All right, let's listen to Peter Johnson now across the pond.
Today, I welcome a new segment guest, Marissa Garcia from Denmark. Marissa, welcome across the pond.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk in future segments about aviation and aerospace in the wider Scandinavia. But first, let's learn a bit more about you and your business. Tell us about you and Flight Chick.
Well, I've been involved in aviation since 1994 when I got, I started working at a manufacturer of life-saving equipment and interiors, and I just got the aviation bug. I was there for 16 years. And afterwards, took a break to pursue my writing passions, which has been all my life to get involved in writing. And I decided to come back and actually write for the industry that I'm so hooked on. So Flight Chic is my own little media aspire, I like to call it, because it's hardly an empire. And I write about aviation issues, safety, interiors, trends, cabin design, and that sort of thing.
Right. And you've got some interesting stories on the site at the moment, some pretty relevant ones. Interested and intrigued in your passenger experience items. But of course, there are wider issues going on in the industry. How do you keep abreast of some of those issues?
I read all day, every day. I read from morning to night, and I read many points of view. I try to stay up to date on what the key news trends are, but I also like to research the things no one's talking about, the regulatory side, the things that may fall off the radar. I'm very curious, so I like to dig deeper and find out what's behind the scenes.
Yeah, okay. Let me dig a little deeper and talk a little bit about your aviation background. How did it really start? How did you get ingrained in this industry?
Well, to be honest, I sued my former employer. I was working in a completely different industry in personnel placement, and they failed to pay an invoice of mine. So I sued them for that. And the owner of the company became so fascinated with my capabilities that he said, not only am I going to pay your invoice, I'm going to offer you a job. And it sounded like a really far-fetched idea, so therefore I did it. And I went into the manufacturing plant there, learned the intricacies of how interiors products are made, how they're designed, the safety equipment as well. And I was fascinated by the regulations, by the processes, by what makes an airline choose one product over another. And it, I just couldn't give it up. It was just an amazing, amazing career.
And have you ever thought about getting behind the stick yourself or being more involved in that side of the industry?
Flying a plane, you mean?
Yeah.
No, no, no. I'm glad to have other people who are cleverer than I do that.
I don't know about that.
I enjoy being in the seat.
Well, let's have a look at the aviation sector in starting with Denmark then. I don't know much about that part of the world. Who are the main airlines? Where are the main airports?
Well, the main airport in Denmark is Kastrup in Copenhagen. That's the big international hub. But there are actually a number of significant regional airports. And for those who are less familiar perhaps with Denmark, Copenhagen is an island separate from the peninsula itself. So for those of us who are living in Jutland, as it's called, the peninsula, it's not always convenient to get out to Copenhagen. It can be easily a 3 or 4 hour drive. So therefore, there are some key airports in the regions which also service international flights, predominantly to the continent and to Britain. They're not going to far away locations, not long haul, but there are some key ones. One of them is very close to me. It's Billund. It's a very convenient airport to use. And they have quite a number of flights and carriers who service there. The predominant ones are SAS themselves, KLM, EasyJet. EasyJet is out of Copenhagen. But Ryanair and Lufthansa does a lot of service out of Billund. And then you have Aalborg in the north, which also has a good presence from key carriers.
And what about international destinations? Where are they serviced out of?
Copenhagen.
Right, okay, okay. And so you mentioned some airlines there. We've featured Ryanair quite regularly. They've come up in pretty much every European segment we've talked about. What's the health of the industry like?
Well, I would say that it's good here in Denmark because people in Denmark like to travel. I mean, it's their number one thing to do. I cannot think of a single person I know here who doesn't try to take at least one holiday a year, if not two. They may choose budget locations, many of them. And in fact, there's a service here called Spies, which is really Thomson in the UK. Yeah. Many, many people like to buy their package holidays from Spies and go to different bargain locations. But the point is they'd like to travel. So it's very active. There's good business. And the airports are responding to that by trying to grow, all of them.
I mentioned the passenger experience. Obviously, there's a big range of airlines you mentioned there, from the low-cost carriers through to some of the legacy carriers. How are the legacy carriers responding to pressures from Ryanair and EasyJet?
Well, where they have to respond, which is to continental flights, they're responding well. They have competitive fares. They may not be quite as competitive as EasyJet or Norwegian Airlines or Ryanair, but they have some advantages in the schedules. They have the advantages in the schedules are quite significant, actually. Right. And, of course, there's the fact that there's also the convenience of the end airport, you know, the connections.
Yeah.
So they have a winning strategy there, I would say.
Right. Okay, Marissa, that's probably all we've got time for today. Thank you very much for your insight. Maybe we can widen our interest in future segments to the wider Scandinavian region. But for now, where can we find out about you online?
Well, you can find me at flightsheet.com. and at DesignerJet on Twitter.
Wonderful. Marissa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, good. Thanks, Peter. Marissa Garcia, I met her virtually a little while ago because she was the guest on episode 7 of Mary Kirby's PaxX podcast, the Passenger Experience podcast. Marissa's great. If she's available to spend some more time in the future talking with Peter, that would be great. She knows her stuff really well.
And I always like it when we have ladies on the show.
It doesn't happen as often as it should.
You're right. But when it does, they're always really cool.
All right, let's move on to some listener mail. And actually, David, we received a recording from one of our listeners. This is concerning our recent conversations about FLARM. What we had is that Renee has sent in a little recording where he talks about FLARM and what it is and some of the details about it, and we really appreciate that. So why don't we listen to Renee right now?
Hello, Airplane Geeks. This is Renee from Germany. In one of the last sessions, you raised a question about the FLARM system, and let me please give you an explanation how this works. So I'm a glider pilot in Germany, and FLARM was developed originally by glider pilots to avoid mid-air collisions between gliders. It's a very efficient and low-cost system. It's approximately about 600 to 800 euros. It's a low power-consuming system. You know, it's always difficult to get enough energy within a glider. It's easy to install, and it's just a small box, like one, two, 4 inches, something like that. Okay. Most European gliders are equipped with the FLARM system, and in some countries like Switzerland and Austria, it's mandatory. That's due to flying in the Alps. You can remember white glider against white snowy background. That's not easy to indicate. Okay. How does it work? Yeah, the effective range of the FLARM system is about 5 to 8 kilometers. And each FLARM includes a GPS receiver and a onboard computer calculates permanently the own flight vector, like speed, course, and so on. And it broadcasts permanently the results of its calculation, like own position and own vector. All other FLARMs in range receive that information and compare it with their own vectors. And if there is a crossing within a range of 30 seconds, it will be indicated, optical and by sound. So that's the first beep you get. And if there is a potential collision within 8 seconds, you will get an alarm. And that's really impressive. No? So you have 8 seconds. There are 8 seconds to react, to change something, and the collision is avoided. Okay. We have additional functions within the FLARM system. There is an obstacle database included that indicates cables, towers, and so on. And for that reason, some helicopters are equipped with the FLARM system, especially when they fly through the Alps. And that's also good for us, glider pilots, because we see those FLARM-equipped helicopter targets. Yeah, and in our days, we have some additional features. An example, my FLARM is connected to my navigation system within the glider. And it shows me all FLARM targets on my moving map system within the range of, let's say, 5 miles. So that creates a good situational awareness. And also is my FLARM, no, the GPS of my FLARM is connected to my transponder, and it creates an ADS-B out signal. So each ADS-B capable transponder can receive my signals, and they also aware us as a glider. Okay, so as conclusion, for most European glider pilots, FLARM is an advantage. And to give you an impression of how many gliders here are in the air, at my strip, within a range of 100 kilometers, I will find 40 glider ports. And on a sunny day, hundreds and hundreds of gliders are airborne. And I often get a beep before I can see the glider. So for that, it's really an increase. It's really a safe situation. Okay, that's my expression to the FLARM system. And David, I realized you love the U-52. We have a working example here in Germany, and I was able to take a video shot from a U-52 low passing our strip, and I will send it to you. Okay, so thank you for listening. I always love to listen to your podcast and have pleasure. Now this is Rene from Germany. Bye.
Hey Max, you ever get the feeling that the three of us were the only people on the planet that didn't know what FLARM was, as I still can't say it with a straight face?
Yeah, I think you're right, because we keep getting lots of listener mail from folks who are obviously familiar with it, if not using it themselves or aware of it, and we appreciate that. It's always great to learn something. We know a lot, David, but we don't know everything.
That's true, and gliding is one of our weak areas where we haven't really done enough talking about it. You know, it's one of those things that we need to find a guest that can really talk about gliding.
I've only been in a glider once. I think I mentioned this a long time ago, because it was even longer ago that I was in a glider for an aerobatic glider ride in California, which was quite spectacular. That's the only time I've been upside down in an airplane.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever been in a glider. So, other than like World War II, but never flying. So, the gliding is one of those things that's on the bucket list. Or soaring.
I often get email from people who are not aviation fanatics or geeks themselves, but have a the spouse, a parent or a spouse who is, and for their, typically for their 50th anniversary, they want to get them a ride in a Warbird. Oftentimes it's a P-51 Mustang, but more generally it's just, you know, some kind of a Warbird. And they're looking for where do they go to do that. And what I usually explain to them is that you can do that, but it's probably going to cost quite a bit more than you expect. And that if you're not that flush with cash, an alternative can be to give a gift in a glider ride, because it doesn't cost as much, nearly as much. But in terms of the wow factor, it's pretty far up there, David.
Yeah, I can imagine. On the bucket list is jumping out of a perfectly good airplane. Though I've been in an airplane while people have jumped out of it, when I flew with the Golden Knights and a glider. I've done the open cockpit. There is still the steerman flight that I'm bucking for. But yeah, a glider definitely is one of those things that I'd love to do. But
yeah,
I guess we should get some more on. We've got a lot of listener mail, so we should keep going, I think. Don't you think?
Yes, and we heard from Gary in Christchurch, New Zealand. He said he was just catching up on all of our great stuff. He said he loved the interview with Doug Stewart in episode 288. And that was Douglas from the Society of Aviation and Flight Instructors. He says, I do, however, disagree with his emperor wish. He says, I first started to learn to fly a glider, a Blahnik Winchtofen, I don't know how you pronounce this.
Well, Okia? All right. I know Oakia.
How about Oakia?
All of our Kiwi guys are right now rolling over. But yeah, Oakia Air Base.
That looks right. And he says, I would argue for many reasons, not least the conquering of the tyranny of the slipstring. Spending the first few hours in a non-powered aircraft creates a pilot more in tune with his or her machine, and that makes for better instinctive reactions when things go wrong, which is, I think, kind of interesting. He says, so rather than a simple powered tail dragger, I would advocate that the first hours learning to fly are spent in something without an engine, whether this is a glider, a sailplane, or whatever. Just my quick thoughts. So I think that's kind of interesting advice and probably pretty good. I'm always an advocate of, learning the underlying physics, or in case of aircraft, the aerodynamics, or, whatever it is. Of what you're doing. So many people kind of learn by the seat of their pants, by just experience, without really understanding sort of the underlying science beneath it. And it makes sense to me that flying an unpowered aircraft would really teach you some of the basics in a real effective manner.
So, and what is it Lisa says? Let's give a shout out to your wife. What's her, you can't sew without making the thread or what is she?
Close. Yes. That's right. She's
got a great, now I blew it.
It's spinning. You can't learn to knit really well unless you know how to spin yarn. And that's sort of the analogy in the, in the fiber enthusiasts world is, you get out there with a drop spindle and actually make some yarn out of wool. And that teaches you something about, the yarn that you then learn how to, knit into all kinds of things. So it's in another area. It's a non-aviation example. But, I think.
I like the phrase. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's great.
The next one's from Hillel, and this was last week. You mentioned for a poll whether to go out to dinners with listeners on Friday before or Saturday immediately following the Be a Pilot Day at the Udvar-Hazy Center. I suggest Saturday, since everyone's driving ways to get there may not be up for driving 2 days in a row, even though the schedules allow it. Also, the D.C. area traffic is
difficult.
A challenge on Fridays. So quiet time would be better as long as you're all getting enough standby. So we'll keep it open, but it does sound like Saturday because we have a surprise for us on Fridays. And I think us and our families are going to want to geek out Friday night. And I think so. I think probably we will do our meet and greet and social up on Saturday night. What do you think, Max?
I think that makes a whole ton of sense. So everybody who is going to be down for the event in June, Father's Day on Saturday at the Udvar-Hazy Center at the next to Dulles Airport, yeah, please plan on, this could be dangerous, joining us for dinner afterwards. We're not paying for dinner. Maybe Rob will. Maybe we could say that Rob's going to bite. No, we probably shouldn't, huh?
No, well, you know, he does have that new gig on Fox.
Maybe he could swing it. But in any event, we'll pick a local place, probably the same place we did last year.
We usually do the Red Robin, which is right outside the south gate of the museum. If you parked in the normal parking lot, it's maybe a 5 or 6 minute ride. Everybody seems to have a good time, and we've always seemed to have a really good reception there with the staff. They don't mind setting up a big table for us, and we have a good time and talk shop, and we look forward to hanging out. And again, for those people who won't be able to stay for dinner or go out, we do promise that we will be having a rope line set up, and you will be able to come up and ask for our autographs, and we'll shake your hands, and you can proceed down the line. No, we're gonna just have an hour open so people can actually come and talk to us without us frantically shoving a mic into someone's face or us trying to do recording or run around the museum. So we're definitely looking forward to that chunk of time.
Yeah, very good. All right. Let's see. Let's move on. We heard from Patrick. He said he was flying over a local airport, and I guess he looked down and he saw an airport compass rose. You know what an airport compass rose is, right, David?
Yeah, it's a compass. It tells you where north, south, east, west is. And they could be, in the 20s and 30s, they were a visual marker when we didn't have a lot of the electronics. So what Patrick is suggesting was we'll put up his picture, a contest or maybe just everybody send in your local airport's compass rose, see what, and the fanciest maybe we'll figure out buttons or something. But yeah, definitely it's a piece of nostalgia that's very practical. I mean, that's how you orient your aircraft. So definitely it was theirs is very pretty. I like the orange and white.
Yeah, it looks good. This is from Delta Municipal Airport in Delta, Utah. And if you don't know what we're talking about here, what an airport compass rose is, take a look in the show notes and you'll see this picture. And if you've got some photos of other compass roses from other airports, send them along and we'll take a look. We'll probably put them up on the webpage and see who's got the most interesting or the fanciest compass rose. I think it's a great idea. It sounds like fun.
Yep. The next one's from Cal. Hi, guys. I heard that a CVR, which is, I know this, is impressive, a cockpit voice recorder, is only good for about 2 hours, after which it erases previous content. Question, what's the actual format on the CVR? Is it actual magnetic tapes? What prevents a CVR from having longer times? Well, you know, folks, it's really just an 8-track tape.
Yeah, pretty close. Although we're seeing some of the newer ones are solid
digital
state. Yes. But for a long time, yeah, that's been it. It's been sometimes a loop of tape, and so that when it gets to the beginning again, it writes over what had been recorded previously.
Well, and the other part about it, he says, I can understand why the last 2 hours might be useful, but it seems like a big oversight that it's only 2 hours. But at any event, it's recording, so, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I don't know of an airline event that lasts longer than 2 hours or 3 hours. I mean, in this case, for Malaysia 370, yeah, that's not the norm. Normally, accidents occur on takeoff and landing, which is the first 2 hours or the last 2 hours. Don't you agree, Max?
Yeah, and of course, I think most people know that or realize that there's really two recorders. There's a cockpit voice recorder, and then there's the flight data recorder. two different things. And you know, I understand that the FAA requirement for the cockpit voice recorder is actually only 30 minutes, but the NTSB does recommend at least 2 hours, and most do record for 2 hours. But I think it's a great point. I mean, you know, in these days of 16, 32, 64 gigabyte flash drives, we could record longer than that, I'm sure. But, you know, like you say, David, the spoken part, the reactions or whatever the pilots, the flight crew is saying that may want to be analyzed afterwards probably doesn't extend for much longer than 2 hours, probably in most cases much less. Tom wrote in. He says he's listening to episode 291. We were talking about the A-10s being possibly removed from service. He does say that while he often agrees with David, he vehemently disagrees with the opinion on the A-10. Now, he notes that the Air Force has been trying to get rid of these for years because he says they don't like flying close air support. The Marines and the Army, on the other hand, would love to have them, he says, because of the Key West Agreement. Because of the Key West Agreement, this will never be able to happen. Conflicts of the future are not likely to be fought in aircraft to aircraft. If they are our F-15, 16s, and 22s, they're more capable to handle anything out there today. David, the Key West Agreement, maybe you can explain that?
The Key West Agreement was that basically, at one point, Army Aviation had their own aircraft, and they wanted to get into the close support business, and the Air Force got a little upset that, you know, airplanes should be flown by the Air Force. And they sort of made the agreement. This is when things like C-7 Caribous were transferred from the Army to the United States Air Force during the Vietnam conflict, that the Army were going to have helicopters, and they could have attack helicopters, but they couldn't have really armed fixed-winged aircraft. So that was the purveyance of the United States Air Force. The Navy, of course, have aircraft because of aircraft carriers, and the Marines as a spinoff of that because they are deployable. So that was the breakdown. But unfortunately, Thomas, I knew that my comments about the A-10 were going to be unfavorable to by a lot of people. But unfortunately, I have the background in knowing what's involved with the infrastructure to keep an A-10 with special hangars and special weapon systems and the loader for the Gatling gun. All of those things are one-off pieces of hardware that support the A-10 that where you can use a lot of same hardware for support for like F-16s and F-15s. They have the same engine, so they have the same support. That kind of infrastructure for a single type aircraft gets very expensive very quickly. So again, as much as I don't not love the A-10, it's time for it to go. And I understand that that's not necessarily the common opinion, and a lot of it's the emotional ties to aircraft. I remember a lot of the same arguments when they were retiring the F-14 Tomcat. So It's getting a little too expensive to keep a one-off airplane that does something very well. It will always be the best of what it ever did. But in this day where you have to pick and choose and you got to get your biggest bang for the buck, I know the F-35 is not it, but we definitely can't have specialized aircraft anymore in this day and age that are designed to do one thing.
It's interesting to me how we get so attached to particular aircraft. I mean, I really love the A-10, and not for real rational reasons. I used to see them flying overhead from the National Guard up at Bradley Field all the time, and it was just great fun to hear the engines on those things and know immediately what they were and just, you know, dash out of the house and look up and just watch them fly by. I mean, as simple as that. Also, for some strange reason, my wife has always had some kind of a strong affinity for that Gatling gun. I'm not really exactly sure what that's all about, but that makes the A-10 her favorite as well. We got an email from Neil. Neil says he just finished enjoying episode 291. He has a couple of comments regarding the listener mail. He says there was a discussion regarding external cameras and viewing availability on IFE, particularly cameras in the nose wheel. And this is our conversation about how we just really love it and have in the past, or when there's an opportunity to watch the view from a camera mounted on the airplane. He says that these cameras, again, this is on nose wheel. He says these cameras are not for passenger enjoyment. Rather, they are for pilot ground navigation and simply made available on IFE. He says when turning on at a taxiway intersection, pilots may use judgmental oversteering. Rather than nose wheel tracking on the center line of the turn, the pilot will use judgment to steer the nose wheel wide of the center line as a measure of safety to keep the main gear from tracking off the runway edge on the inside of the turn. For very long airplanes, such as the 777-300, the A340-600, the 747-8, and the A380, a camera and monitor are used to allow the pilot to verify the nose gear is also remaining on the taxiway on the outside of the turn. So, I guess that's a kind of an interesting point that, you know, if you're watching a nose wheel camera and all of a sudden the nose wheel is deviating significantly from the center line and you don't realize what's going on and that that's intentional, I could see how that would kind of upset some passengers.
Windows.
I just look out the window. Neil also says David made reference to visits to Chicago and hearing direction for his plane to go to the penalty box. I remember you were listening on to ATC on the plane, right? Then you heard that.
Yeah,
music.
It was United. So it was flight. What was it? Channel 9 on United.
Right, Channel 9, yes. Well, so he sends some interesting information. I didn't realize. He says the FAA has standardized naming conventions for runways, taxiways, and aprons at all airports to enhance operational safety. He says while today's naming conventions for runways and taxiways are requirements, many of the historically named facilities remain, including O'Hare's penalty box hold apron west of the terminal along taxiway B. The penalty box is a frequently used temporary home for aircraft that have landed but don't have an available gate. So he says, thanks. Enjoy the podcast and thanks. So, yeah, that's it's interesting. Thanks to Neil.
And, Neil, thank you for making me realize that I didn't imagine that. And, folks, I did not make that up.
Yeah. Ian Kershaw also wrote in on cameras. He said that conversation, which led to the QF-32 book, and Ian says this is a first-class read and an eye-opener. He says, recommended, and as a follow-up, download the free PDF of the official report from the Australian government. So Ian's got, this is not a surprise if you have sort of followed Ian, but he said he's looking through his iBook collection. He's got a couple of favorites. Well, actually more than a couple. There are quite a few here. I don't know if you're familiar with any of these, David, but he's got Command and Control by Eric Schlosser, an in-depth review of the Cold War ICBM silos. He says, Deadly Departure, TWA 800 by Christine Negroni. Christine, of course, is a past guest. We talked a bit about that. Also, Tales of My Time by Raymond Baxter. He says, more likely of interest to the Brits. Wings on My Sleeve by Eric Winkle Brown. And, of course, Understanding Air France 447, Riding Rockets, Boeing Dreamliner, Airbus 380, Aviation at the Edge. With anything that Roland White or Tony Blackman has authored. And then he throws in this because he knows that I'm an F1 fan. He says, any F1 fans out there, I have more to share. If the Isle of Man TT stirs your blood, Dave Mulineau's The Racer's Edge. He says, but I digress.
That was the reading list just for you.
Yes, that was true. And he also mentions Ethiopian 767, which we didn't really talk about. He said one crew member left the cockpit. The remaining pilot locked the door and trotted off to Switzerland seeking asylum. So Ian says, so locking the door from inside and no means to open from the main cabin, and we have no alternate communication system in the cabin. He says, who signed off on that? That one does at the design stage, and who allowed or indeed enforced its adoption across the world's fleet? Some progress that allows flammable liquids in the cabin. That's a prime theme for one of Rob's 1 minute specials. So that might be a good one. Once you're locked out, you're locked out. And if whoever's on the business end of the cockpit door has some other thoughts about what's going to happen next, there's really no effective way to get in there.
Yeah, kind of. Well, there is a reason why we have one-way lock crew doors, and we hope that basically that this kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Yep.
So,
all right. Well, David, I think that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. A little bit of a shorter episode than most. I hope. I know we get a lot of listeners who would like it if we made it even longer than normal, but this one's on the short side.
This is for the other 50% that say we should only do a half hour show.
That's right. Okay, so we want to thank our contributors as always, Grant McCarron, Steve Vischer. Find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. Special thanks to Ben for filling in for Grant this week. Also, thanks to Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment, and you can find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, David, let's tell our listeners where they can find you online.
Well, I'm not on Fox News, so you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. Check out our websites, airplanegeeks.com/Facebook, Airplane Geeks on Twitter. And then, of course, don't forget that other show where it's just Max and I, the UAV Digest, otherwise known as Airplane Geeks Light. And that comes out every Friday.
Very good. And Rob Mark, who's not with us, and hopefully will be back next week, you can find him at jetwine.com. You can find him as Jetwine on Twitter and probably Jetwine everywhere else.
That's about right.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Also, as David mentioned, the UAVDigest.com and at RunwayGirlNetwork.com for the PaxX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find full show notes for this episode at AirplaneGeeks.com. Or if you want to get straight to this episode, you can use the shortcut AirplaneGeeks.com/292. Let's see. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. Also find us on TuneIn.com. And, of course, we have an email address. If you want to send us an email, it's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can always leave us a brief audio message. Aunt Bonet, what can you say about that?
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Bonet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.